This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Being president means constantly dealing with crises and with problems that have great consequences but no easy solutions. Our first guest, journalist Michael Lewis, wanted to know what it's like to be President Obama. Lewis managed to get the president to agree to let him spend time with him over a six-month period, observing the president in the White House and on his travels and conducting interviews. Lewis's article, Obama's Way, is published in the current edition of Vanity Fair. Lewis is the author of the bestsellers Moneyball, Liar's Poker, and The Big Short. Terry recorded her interview with Michael Lewis last Tuesday.
Michael Lewis, welcome back to Fresh Air. Whose idea was writing a piece about Obama based on spending months with him? Not all the time with him, but based on being with him off and on over a period of months.
It was my idea. I wrote an email to Jay Carney, the press secretary, last November and said, this is sort of a flaky request, but someone should write a piece just trying to put the reader in the president's shoes, because you see all of this commentary about why Obama's done this or why he hasn't done that, and all this hysteria around the office of the president, and it just seems so implausible. You just know that there's a man sitting there trying to do a job with more information about the decisions he's making than all the people who are criticizing the decisions. Let's go sit in his shoes and see what it feels like. I did not think this was going to come to anything. I got a call the next day from Jay Carney saying, we really want to do this. And I said, who's we? And he said, he really wants to do it. And I said, what about everybody else at the White House? And he said, we really don't want to do it. And so there proceeded to be this kind
of
two-month
game. Wait,
who was
the he, President Obama or Jay Carney?
Yes.
So the president wanted to do it. Jay Carney didn't want him to do it?
No, Jay Carney was okay with it, but the rest of the White House just didn't have a very good feeling about it. Nobody could see the upside of letting me in to wander around in the president's life, which is what I was asking to do. I said, I've got to basically come and loiter and just kind of get to know him. And it's going to be very free-flowing. I want to do things like play basketball with him. I said I wanted to caddy for him on the golf course. I wanted to be in meetings. I wanted to just kind of be around. And no one had ever done this. In fact, it's not clear to me anybody's ever done this with a president in modern times. It was a radical request, and I didn't think they would do it. So they invited me to the White House in January for what amounted to, felt like a Goldman Sachs job interview. I was shuffled from important person just to talk about my interest in this subject without any understanding that I would ever see the president. And at the end of this day, a White House press person comes running into my meeting and says, Michael, you have to leave now. And I thought they were throwing me out. I thought that I'd offended somebody. It was entirely possible. They had no reason to think I was even pro-Obama. I mean, I'd been pals with McCain, and that was on the record. So she grabs me out of this meeting and kind of takes me on a race walk through the White House. And before I know it, I'm sitting in the Oval Office with him. And it was just the two of us for 45 minutes, and we had a chat about how this might work. And he was very easy about it.
In that 45-minute meeting, that first meeting that you had with President Obama, what did he want to hear from you about how this piece would proceed if he gave his permission?
I think the first thing he said was, so how much did you have to do with the movie of Moneyball? that was the kind of thing we were talking about. He said, I didn't really have much to do. He said, that's what I thought. He said, and then he wanted to talk a bit about the financial crisis, because I think he had read The Big Short, the book I'd written about the financial crisis. And I tell you, when I walked into his office, this is what I walked in on. He was sitting there laughing over an email someone had sent him. And he was then coaching his two daughters in basketball. And say one was in the fifth grade and one was in the eighth grade. So he was coaching the fifth and eighth grade basketball teams at his children's school. And the email he showed me was from an outraged parent of a seventh grader at the school saying, why wasn't the president coaching the seventh grade team too? And he said, this is what I deal with all day kind of thing. It was the conversation we had in those 45 minutes. And where those 45 minutes came from, I have no idea. It was amazing to me that he had them at the time. But he just wanted to talk. He didn't really ask, what do you need or what's your angle? Never in all of our dealings did he ask a question like that.
Let's talk about one of the big decisions President Obama had to make, and that was what to do about Libya, which you write about in some detail in your piece. How much of the time he spent making that decision were you actually with him?
Well, it was that was a year before I came on the scene, and when I first started talking to him about what it was like to be president, it became pretty clear that you come in with this master plan of what you want to do, and then the world throws crisis after crisis at you, and you have to respond very quickly. And so you create an environment for yourself where you maximize the likelihood that you're going to make good decisions. And he led me to the general idea that I should frame this piece around a single decision. And the decision about Libya was so interesting because at the time, it seemed very, very risky. It was a decision to essentially invade an Arab country by a president who had campaigned on getting out of wars. And it was something that was just thrust out of, upon him from left field, these Arab uprisings, the Arab Spring starts. And all of a sudden, he's got problem after problem on his hands. And the Libyan situation was even more interesting than some of the others because it was a real-time event that he had to respond to very quickly. Gaddafi was on the move across the Libyan desert on his way to massacre a city full of Libyans in Benghazi. They were somewhere north of 1 million people in this city, and Gaddafi had pledged to go house to house and cleanse Libya of the rats, as he put it. And all the intelligence said that, you know, this could be a genocide. And the question was, what do we do about it? And you were on a clock. It was just a question of how long it took Gaddafi to get to these people. The French and the English were pushing for creating a no-fly zone over Libya. And the no-fly zone would prevent, of course, Gaddafi's jets from flying. But the problem was Gaddafi wasn't flying. He was on the ground. It didn't matter. It wasn't going to save these people. So Obama's in this situation when, you know, a million other things are going on. He's evaluating the plans to assassinate Osama bin Laden. He's grappling with arguments over the budget with congressional Republicans. He's got one thing after another to do. And then in the middle of his day, he has to go to a meeting about this. What are we going to do about Gaddafi murdering a million people in Libya? He gets to this meeting, and it's a meeting of a large number of his cabinet. And they're sitting around a table, and they offer him his options. The Pentagon offers the options. The options are do nothing at all or join the French and the British in creating this no-fly zone.
So President Obama basically asks, and if we do a no-fly zone, is that going to be effective? He's basically told, no, it's not.
So he asks, so these are my options you've given me. Is this going to save these people? And the answer is no. But this happens often in the life of a president. The people who are giving him advice don't give him all his options. The advice is biased because the Pentagon does not want to go into Libya. So he has to make them go back to come up with an option that would save these people so he can at least contemplate it. But what's interesting is the way he does this. He tries not to queer the process of the meeting itself by expressing what his view is. Instead, he insists on people who are around the room who are junior people who have different views of the Libyan situation. He insists on hearing their views, knowing that they will say, we need to at least consider saving these people. So he elicits the views of people who normally wouldn't be included in this discussion. At the end of this first meeting, the Pentagon goes away and to come up with another option in 2 hours. And Obama goes to some state dinner. Comes back 2 hours later, and they give them this third option. The third option is to bomb Gaddafi on the ground. And it's an operation that the U.S. has to take the lead in. And what was so interesting about this, in addition to the president having to solicit an option that his advisor didn't give him, was that there wasn't anybody, no senior person in his administration, who wanted him to do what he ends up doing. He has no constituency to go and save those people. The system is telling him, don't do it, or do something that protects you politically, create a no-fly zone, but don't actually take action and put the American military on the line.
So how does he decide to handle that?
His vice president and his chief of staff, Biden and Daley, are saying, there's absolutely no political upside to you going in and doing anything. This could only go wrong. The Pentagon people are saying we're stretched thin as it is, and there's a real likelihood that if we go in with the French and the English, if it goes wrong or it gets messy, it's going to be our problem. So he says, no, we're going to make sure it's not going to be our problem. And he goes and he calls Sarkozy and Cameron, leaders of France and England, and make sure they're on the hook for the operation after we've done the initial dirty work. But nevertheless, it was interesting, this decision was so interesting to me because unlike many of the issues that the president is engaged with, this was a case where he had enormous power and could have his way. He could sort of express who he was through the decision. It wasn't like a budget negotiation with the Republicans where essentially the Congress has him can have his way with him. He had real latitude. You could see his fingerprints on the thing. You could see in some way express who he really was by the way he went about this. And you could also see the pressures in the world on the president as he did this thing. But in the lead up to the bombing of Gaddafi's troops, he was getting enormous grief for not having done anything for letting Gaddafi move through the desert unimpeded. Republicans, Democrats were screaming at him to do something. The minute he turns and does something, the very same people who are screaming at him to do something on cable news are screaming at him for doing it. Look what you've got us into. It's going to end badly. So on and so forth. You saw that in some weird way, your job as president is just to be abused by everybody who isn't while you try to do the thing that you think is the best to do.
One of the things you talked to President Obama about was what it was like to be opposed every step of the way politically by Republicans in the House and the Senate. And he tells you that he underestimated how little it would cost Republicans politically to oppose ideas they had once advocated and to oppose them now merely because Obama supported them. What else did he have to tell you about the opposition that he continues to face politically?
Well, the way we got onto this subject, actually, is I was talking to him about the powers of the modern presidency. On the one hand, he has these godlike powers to go save whole cities in Libya. On the other hand, when he gets up and talks, nobody listens anymore. And I was talking to him about the bully pulpit. You know, there is a school of thought that argues that the president's chief source of power is the bully pulpit. And he was saying the bully pulpit's broken. It's not what it was, and it's broken and fractured because of the nature of the media climate that we operate in, and it's broken in part because of the attitude of the opposition to me, as he put it. And his point was that if he gets up and advocates something, Republicans in Congress have had a strategy of opposing it simply because he's for it, so that it can be the worst sort of strategy for him to get up and advocate something if he wants to get anything done. And he said that he, you know, recognized when he came into office that that was the climate he was in, but he assumed that the American people would punish the other side for being so obstructionist. And he said that what happened instead was the approval ratings of Congress as a whole plummeted to basically zero, but individual politicians didn't pay a price. Mitch McConnell does not pay a price for adopting that strategy. His base back home in Kentucky celebrates his actions. But Obama personally pays a price. His approval ratings are lower because he seems to not be getting so much done with Congress. The only relationship that we talked about that he has is anything like that in his life is with Russia, Putin's Russia. He says, you know, when the United States wants to do something, the Russians are instinctively against it just because we want to do it, like going and saving a million people in Libya. Why would the Russians disapprove of that? They disapprove of it simply because we want to do it. But he was funny because he said that with the Russians, you know, he's made some progress, that he can get beyond that sometimes and find common ground. With the Republicans, there's been very little progress.
Did you get a sense of how President Obama reacts to being hated by so many people on the far right who think he's a communist or a Muslim and that he's really lying about his faith or that he's lying about being an American citizen because he's not really?
Yes, I did. He said that you've got to realize, and you would realize instantly when you're in the job. You learn this on the campaign, he said. is that virtually everything that's said about you is not about you. It's about the person who's doing the speaking. And this isn't just negative stuff. It's positive stuff, too. The Barack Obama that they're talking about is an expression of people's fears of out-of-control liberalism or black hope and pride. But it's not you. And so he's very good, just psychologically, at putting distance between himself and what's said about him, at kind of just stepping back and looking at it as if it's about another person. And I think he feels that way about it. And he says that, but the problem is in that environment where so much of what is said is nonsense, you've got to filter for the few things that actually make sense, or else you're living in a fantasy land. But he's already, for example, decided that nothing on cable news is worth listening to. He doesn't watch it. He thinks it's totally toxic. It, like, infects your brain, and he won't turn on the TV. But he does read the newspapers.
Because he has to make so many very difficult decisions as president, you say that President Obama eliminates a lot of the decisions that most of us have to make in our daily lives. What are some of the decisions he consciously has tried to eliminate from life?
And it is very conscious. It's interesting. He's actually aware of research that shows that the more decisions you have to make, the worse you get at making decisions. And he analogizes to going shopping at, like, Costco. You go to Costco and you don't know what you want, you come out exhausted because your mind is making all these decisions. And he wants to take those kind of decisions out of his life. So he chucked out all his suits except for his blue and his gray suits, so he doesn't have to think about what he puts on in the morning. Food is just arranged for him. He's not making any decisions about what he's eating. Essentially, what most people spend most of their life deciding about, he's had those decisions removed from his life. So he does this, so he creates an environment, a mental environment, where he's got full energy for the decisions that are really important decisions.
What is his routine?
Okay, he gets up I think of his day as starting the night before, because he's such a night owl. Left to his own devices, he'd stay up to 4 in the morning and sleep till noon, I think. His wife goes to bed at 10 o'clock. He has from about 10 to 1 when he goes to bed as a stretch of time. It's really his time. It's when he can write, for example. It's when he can read books. It's when he can dial up foreign leaders who are in different time zones. But he has that period in the residence. It's really kind of sacred, I think, for him. He goes to bed at 1. He gets up at 7. He putzes around for 15 minutes, and then he goes to the gym just above his bedroom. He's in and out of there in an hour. He reads a security briefing report, and he walks to the Oval Office at 9 o'clock. Unless he's traveling, he's done at 6, and he's home having dinner with the kids at 6. So that's kind of the frame of his day.
So you did some traveling with President Obama on Air Force One. Describe how Air Force One is different from the kind of planes the rest of us fly on.
Well, first off, it's louder because it's heavier. It's got all the strange equipment on it, so they have extra big engines. And it gets louder and louder.
What kind of strange equipment is on it?
Well, they've got all this navigation equipment. I can't explain, but you go to the cockpit, it doesn't look like a cockpit of a normal commercial airliner. They explain to you also how the plane has never landed off more than 3 seconds off its scheduled arrival time. But there's an operating room. So anyway, it's loud.
As in because he's got surgery operating room?
Yes, he can be operated on. You know, I went and poked around the doctor's closets. The most curious thing I found was an anti-cyanide kit. It looked like something out of James Bond. But the back of the plane is where they keep the press pool. And then there, right in front of them, there's a whole cabin full of essentially ninjas. Guys with machine guns and, you know, machetes and so on and so forth who protect the president. And then in front of that, there's a room where I was seated. It's a room with big, wide doors on either side of the plane It was designed so that a president's coffin can come in and out of the plane easily. You were reminded over and over when you're with a president of the morbidity of that you've got press following him because he might get shot. You've got, you know, a place for his coffin in the plane. That's the thing that kind of, one of the strange things about this job is the way when you're in it, you are constantly reminded that people want you dead.
One of the things you did with President Obama was play basketball with him. What did you learn about him from playing basketball?
Quite a bit. I asked to play basketball with him and having no idea what the game was like. And he didn't really warn me. I showed up at the White House one morning, and he comes down. He actually, he was preceded by the valet carrying his Under Armour red, white, and blue high-top sneakers. And he comes down, and he's looking for his mouth guard. And I said, it's just basketball. Why do you need a mouth guard? He goes, sometimes I get teeth knocked out. And the election's in 100 days, and I don't want to get my teeth knocked out before the election. I said, you know, what kind of game is this? He goes, well, it can get rough. And we went to the basketball court we played on was in the FBI. We drove over to the FBI, and on the court is what looks like, it's not exactly an NBA team, but the guys were serious basketball players. Everybody played at a major college level, and a lot of the guys had played professionally. And it's a regular basketball game that meets three or four times a week that Obama slots into every now and then. And I was shocked at the level of competition. I thought, my God, the president's 50 years old. He didn't start for his high school basketball team. How good could he be? But he was actually good enough to function in this environment. And when you watched him play or played with him, you noticed a few things. One was his insistence that no one treat him like he was the president. He got exactly as much respect and was exactly as abused as a person of his caliber of play should have been in that game. If he found himself isolated on a better player on the other team, the other player just took it to him. If he was open for a shot on his team, but there was someone who was a better shooter who was also open, that other person got the ball. And I said this to one of the players. I said, you know, it's kind of amazing that nobody defers to him. And the player said, you know, if you defer to him, you're not invited back. He doesn't want that. So that told you a lot. He wants to be, one, in a very challenging environment. Two, he really likes relationships between equal. He likes normalcy. He likes to be treated like a normal person. And then the third thing was he was shrewd as can be on the basketball court. He spaced the court very well, and he found ways to get open. And in what looked like a very riskless game, like he was playing a very low-key riskless game, every now and then he'd strike, and he has a really good three-point shot. So he took, in the course of five games we played or six games, he took maybe five shots and made all but one of them. And he'd worked very hard to get to the point where he could take the shot and get a good shot. He also screams at you if you're on his team and you take bad shots. He doesn't put up with it. He was hollering at me. In fact, he hollered at me so much. He hollered at me. He was so embarrassed. I was so embarrassed by being outclassed and feeling like he was going to be pissed off at me if we lost that at some point I kind of snuck out of the game and went and sat with the scorekeeper. But the first time I jacked up a shot that he thought I shouldn't take, he started screaming at me. And the game was over and it was clear his team had won four of the six games, you could see that the reason that his team had won was that the players on his team didn't take stupid shots because they were afraid the president was going to scream at them if they did.
Michael Lewis, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Michael Lewis speaking with Terry Gross. Their interview was recorded last Tuesday. Lewis's article, Obama's Way, is in the October issue of Vanity Fair. You'll find a link to it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Our next guest is comic W. Kamau Bell, host of the new FX series Totally Biased. It's a show of largely political humor that mixes stand-up, brief sketches, and an interview. The show was proposed by Chris Rock, who serves as its executive producer. As an African-American, Bell often addresses race in his comedy, including his take on the first African-American president and the hatred directed at him. Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell is on Thursday nights. Its six-episode season ends September 20th. Terry spoke with Bell last Thursday.
W. Kamau Bell, welcome to Fresh Air. So how would you describe your show for somebody who's never seen it?
I'd say it's a very left-leaning, liberal, politically charged, social politically charged comedy show from a 6'4", 250-pound black man who is steeped in the Bay Area.
And why is the Bay Area important to who you are and what your show is?
I mean, I think I was a different person when I moved to the Bay Area 15 years ago, and I thought I knew who I was, and I got to the Bay Area, and they really, even though I was pretty much an adult, they finished raising me.
We'll get back to that. So you have your show in part because of Chris Rock.
I think he's, you know, almost entirely in part because of Chris Rock. Chris Rock lifted me out of the wilderness and shined me up and put me in a position to get a TV show.
So what happened? He heard your act and then proposed to you to do to do a show?
What happened was I have a solo show that I do called The W. Kamau Bell Curve, Ending Racism in About an Hour. That I've been doing since 2007, and if you bring a friend of a different race, you get in 2-for-1. Which I like to say, not even Martin Luther King Jr. did that on the March on Washington, but of course he also didn't charge admission. I had this solo show, and I was doing it for about 5 years, and, you know, as a comic, once you're in the scene for a while, you sort of are only 1 or 2 degrees away from every other comedian. So I knew people who knew Chris, but, it, you know, I didn't think anything about it. And I met a producer named Chuck Sklar, who has worked with Chris for years, and he basically badgered Chris to go see my show. And then another woman named Jocelyn Cooper, who runs Afropunk.com, who grew up with Chris, badgered him to go see my show. And then I was doing my show at the UCB Theater in New York, and after the show, I was like, that was a great show. And suddenly a figure clad in black floated backstage like the Matrix, and it was Chris Rock.
So was your comedy always political?
No, not at all. I think, I started out as a comic. I mean, I still just want to be funny, you know, even with the label of political. I'm still trying to get big, healthy gut laughs. And I started out as a comic just trying to be funny. And I sort of was all over the map. And I was bad for a really long time. And, you know, I sort of came into this.
I love hearing people's early bad material. Would you grace us with a really bad joke from your early act?
Oh my God! It literally makes my stomach hurt to think about that. My palms are literally sweating.
you're welcome.
Yes, only because you're Terry Gross, and I'm honored to be here. While I actually tell a joke from my early act? Otherwise, I would never do this. I think it was a joke that went somewhere along the lines of, and I haven't told this joke in forever. I met a woman last night, and she said, I want you to take me home, and I want you to make love to me all night long. That's not my fantasy. My fantasy is that a woman says, I want you to take me home and just do your best. Just try real hard. If it doesn't work out tonight, come back tomorrow. That was sadly my closer.
Compare that to how you recently opened your act. And I'm not talking about your TV show now. I'm talking about the act that you did, The Bell Curve, Ending Racism in 1 Hour. You'd open with Tyler Perry jokes.
Yeah, I think at the point that I was doing the Tyler Perry material, I cared a lot about the Tyler Perry material, and I never really cared about that joke I just told you. That was a joke that was written because the audience thought it was funny at that time, whereas the Tyler Perry joke that I did that's on my last CD, Face Full of Flour, was a joke that literally the first time I stepped on stage to do it, I was afraid that the audience might turn on me because I was in front of a lot of black people. But what happened is that it was sort of a release. Like, they were like, you're saying the thing that many of us think. And to me, that's the kind of material I always want to be going for.
What was the thing? What were you saying about Tyler Perry?
It's probably explicit for NPR.
That's why I'm not playing the record. So, yeah, you can clean it up for us.
It was really just the idea that, like, and this was 2 years ago. And that's the thing about my act is that it's really what I cared about 2 years ago is not necessarily the same thing I care about now in the same way. So it's like a little snapshot. And at that point, Obama had just won the presidency. And I said that, well, now that Obama's won the presidency, there's something I've wanted to say for a long time that I feel really passionate about. And now I feel like that we have a black president. I can get this off my chest. And it was basically Tyler Perry. Because at the time, I felt like you couldn't really. There's this thing with black people that we feel like we have to have a unified front, and we have to protect things that even if we don't like them, because we know that at any point one of us can get snatched up and be accused of something we didn't do. And I sort of felt like under the protection of a black president, maybe we could have some more independent opinions. Now, unfortunately, that hasn't changed as much as I thought it would. So, you know, I wouldn't do that joke again today.
So how has it changed your relationship to politics and to political comedy to have an African-American president?
Nobody considered my act political until America got a black president. I talked about race a lot. It just became that once Barack started running for president, I started to care a lot about the presidency in a way that I hadn't cared before. So I started to, because every day on TV, I saw this black guy who was, you know, under a microscope, and I felt like there was some percentage of me in that guy that I didn't see in, say, George W. Bush or even Bill Clinton, despite the fact they insisted he was the black president. And I sort of became engaged in news in a way that I hadn't been engaged before. And also, I think as a facet of getting older, caring about the world around me in a different way. And so my act really, I got labeled a political comedian. That wasn't the thing I was trying to do.
But you do a lot of political humor on your program.
I do. I mean, I think it's also the nature of the election. You know, I feel like I want to have a voice in that. So I want to feel like I want Totally Biased to be a part of the discussion of the election.
Being a comic, being an African-American comic during a period when America has its first African-American president, have you noticed racial things and things about how he's treated that have made you think about race in ways you hadn't thought about it before?
Well, yes. I think that's why my act has gone in such a political direction, because I see the ways in which Obama is treated across the spectrum as things that are connected to his race for me, that I can't help but separate them. And sometimes those things are good things and sometimes those things are bad things. Like very recently, you know, Obama's in Florida and he meets the owner of that pizza restaurant and the guy picks him up and gives him a bear hug. And there's a part of me that goes, that guy likes him and he's excited to see Obama and he loves Obama, so he picks him up. But the other part of me is like, I've never seen that happen to a president before.
I know. I thought, like, really, that seems very kind of, you know, adorable on one hand, but it's crazy. You're not supposed to touch a president unless extends his hand to shake hands with you.
It's adorable and it's also frightening to me. I mean, there's a side of it that, like, you know, and there's an interesting part because Obama gets picked up and you see his arms go out and he looks to his right and I feel like he's looking at the Secret Service going like, hey guys, still the president over here for at least the next few months. And then when he comes down, he looks at the guy in the face and Obama looks ashen. And nobody's really talked about that. He looks like a guy who's like, for a minute, I thought maybe this was over. And, you know, I'm sure he's aware of the responsibility and how, you know, nobody's ever picked him up like that. And then, you know, and yet I connect that in some way. And I'm not mad at that guy. I think he had no bad intentions. But again, I've never seen anybody do that to a president before. And then you look at Jan Brewer, who sticks her finger in the president's face a few years ago. And that's another thing. That doesn't happen to presidents, where a governor would stick their finger in a president's face. And to me, that's very much connected to race.
So let's talk about your background. Where did you grow up?
I grew up all over, but I went to high school in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And then I moved from Chicago to San Francisco 15 years ago. But I was born in Palo Alto, lived in Indianapolis, lived in Boston. My dad's from Alabama, so I've spent a lot of time in Alabama.
Oh, how come you've moved so much?
I had one of those moms who eventually would get fed up with the place and go, we're moving. It was just me and her. And she would eventually just be like, that's enough of this. And so she just had a real wandering spirit, which is a part of me, which is why I think I sort of feel free to get up and go, too.
So you've said that when you moved to the Bay Area, it kind of changed you. That was about 15 years ago. What changed?
In Chicago, I would have identified myself as a Democrat. But when you go to the Bay Area, you realize that's not far enough. You know, and the thing about the Bay Area is that you're surrounded by so many different types of people, and you can choose to just stay with your group and not engage with those different types of people. But I think very naturally, I chose to sort of engage with lots of different types of people. And many of the prejudices that you didn't even realize you have start to sort of melt naturally. And then the other thing is, people in the Bay Area will call you on your prejudice if you hang out with the crew I did in ways that you didn't realize that you were prejudiced. Like when I started doing my solo show, one of my good friends, Martha, said to me, she's like, Kamau, you can't end racism and make sexism worse. And I was like, what do you mean by that? And she went through my solo show and pointed out all the different parts of it that she felt were sexist. And that's a good friend, a friend who will tell you that in a way that you can hear. And that was a real revelation for me, is that you can't sort of pick your issue over other people's issue. That if you want to sort of end the ignorance of something, you have to end all the ignorances, or at least not make some of the ignorances worse.
If you don't mind me saying, I'm really glad she said that.
I think that's the kind of thing
that really needs
to
be said. Yeah. So what did you have to extract from your show?
There was just ways in which I talk about women. Like, it's sort of funny because whenever I start talking about this, there's a lot of the comedy community which will think I'm being oversensitive or too politically correct, but this is really who I am and who I want to be. And we all comics set down rules for themselves, and these are just the rules I set down for myself, but I still have to get the big healthy gut laugh everybody else does. So I'm not trying to claim that I have some high degree of difficulty. But, you know, like, just even referring to women as girls for no reason, you know. And also, like, she said this to me, which had a big impact on me. She's like, you know, in my show, I would say the word bitch a couple times. And she said, Kamau, you know, every time you say that word, you're in some way connected to every black man who ever says that word, because that's a word that through hip hop and popular culture, black men are identified with. And even though you're not saying it in the same context, you're connecting yourself to that in some way. And you have to ask yourself, how badly do you want to use that word? And she said, if you want to use it, fine, but just be aware of that. And for me, it became like, yeah, I don't think I need to use that word then. And it just doesn't, and it doesn't mean that anybody else is necessarily doing it wrong. It just means that's how I choose to be.
What else changed about you from being in San Francisco?
You know, it's funny. I wouldn't have described myself as a homophobe either, but to be in San Francisco and to hang out with the sort of the multi-culti crew that cuts across all lines, including sexuality, I hang out with a lot of people of a lot of different sexualities. And so I really feel in some way not threatened by that in any way, I don't think. And so I'm comfortable joking about it. And I'm also comfortable using my comfort with it to sort of make other people sort of think about their comfort level with it. Like one of the things we did on the show, which I'm really proud of, was the if gay marriage was mandatory, who would you gay marry?
Right, yeah.
And for me, that was a really fun piece to do. And also, in some ways, a very lightly, I don't know, I really enjoyed doing it because what it said is, like, forget what you think about yourself. If you had to put yourself in a different body and you were gay, how would you be in that body? And, you know, and it was a fun game to play with people. And it's fun to be in that space and not be threatened that somehow somebody's going to think I'm gay or somebody's going to – or they're going to think the wrong thing about me. And also go, who cares what people think about me? And also I realize as a black man, black people a lot of times get the bad end of the stick. We're sometimes thought of being the most homophobic group of people, which I think is ridiculous. But I'm also aware of the fact that as a black man on TV who's talking about gayness in a way that's not threatened by it, I think that's kind of a cool thing.
Your wife is white, and you've talked a little bit in your act about what it's like to be a couple with a white woman, the reactions that you get from strangers and the reactions that you get from African-American women. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it was funny. The first time me and my wife went out together, it wasn't even officially a date. We were in a taqueria in San Francisco, and a black woman and a black man came into the taqueria, and the black woman looked visibly shaken and just kept looking and was really sort of like agitated. And my then friend who became my wife was like, what's wrong with her? And I was like, and she had never experienced that. I was like, I think she's mad that we're together. And my wife was like, really? Like, she just couldn't. And she's a cosmopolitan person, but she just never seen anything like that, whereas I sort of had smelled that before. And the woman just got really mad and really, like, agitated, so much to the fact that after they got their tacos, the guy she was with literally escorted her out of the place and put her in the car the way a cop puts somebody in the back of a car, like sort of put his hand on the back of her head and sort of, like, gently guided her down into the car because she was so agitated. You know, and that's in San Francisco. You know what I mean? That's not in the backwoods of some place. That's in San Francisco.
Did she say anything to you?
On her way out, she said, you dating a white girl because you can't handle a black woman. And I very much looked at her and said, maybe. Maybe you're right. Maybe I'm a trifling Negro. Thank God there's white women to take this trifling Negro off your hands.
Did you really say that to her?
I didn't say that to her. I said that another time.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering, like, how quick are you and how willing are you?
How willing am I to enter the fray?
Yeah.
Well, no, generally as a comic, the reason why I think I'm a comic is because I think of the good things later.
Yeah, sure.
If I thought of the good things at the time, I would then be, you know, I don't know, less popular with people. But I think that a lot of the thing that makes me a comic is the thing that makes me go home and go, what? I should have said something different. Oh, I know what I should have said. I'll go say that on stage.
So you have a daughter. I assume she's lighter skinned than you are. What reaction do you get to that?
Well, the funny thing about my daughter is that when she was born, she came out white, like very pale white. So much so that, like, when we brought my wife's family around, like, I remember my brother-in-law, my wife's brother, literally looked at her and looked at me, and I felt like he was going, like, dude, I got to tell you something. But I know, because black people sort of know this because we have probably more experience with this, that the color that a kid is when they're born changes. And so, and it's even true of white kids, that their color, could they come out one color. The funny thing was is that my daughter immediately started getting darker. But I always said that we didn't know where her color would start. And so I always said I would track her color every day to see where her color would start by using the cover of Michael Jackson CDs in reverse chronological order. You know, I would just be like, oh, today it's bad. Yesterday it was dangerous. Maybe we can make it to Thriller. It's never going to be off the wall. Who am I kidding?
So has having an interracial marriage affected your views about race and what it means? Well, like what race means?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it has affected my views about race. Sometimes people will say if you're in an interracial relationship that you're somehow a sellout or you're taking the easy route or something like that. And literally, if you want to talk about race a lot in your life, marry a person who's a different race than you. Because that will become a topic in ways that it didn't, that it probably wouldn't if you marry a person of the same race. Because, I mean, we've had a lot of things, you know, just, you know, I'm aware that when I'm hanging out with my wife's family that I'm the only black person around. And I'm aware that if my wife's cousins start talking about Obama and they're very conservative, they start talking about Obama in ways that makes me want to like, ah, you know. But I also want to make sure I can come back for Thanksgiving. And I get and so I just spend a lot of time being quiet and mentally jotting down notes to use in my act. but yeah, so it certainly becomes a bigger part of your discussion. But I also feel like that it's not the biggest part. The biggest thing that separates me and my wife is the fact that my wife is Catholic, and I like to say I'm sane. You know what I mean? So that's way bigger for us than race.
So what have you learned by being married to a white woman about race that you didn't know before, about how white people perceive African-Americans or some white people perceive African-Americans, and about your own preconceptions about white people?
Well, I mean, let me say this. I've you know, it's funny how to feel like I've said, I've grown up around white people.
That's
Some of my best whites are friends. I've spent a lot of time, you know, it wasn't really like such a guess who's coming to dinner scenario with my wife's family, but it was this thing where, you know, like I always felt like my wife's family sort of took them a while to warm up to me, but I don't think it was because I was black. I think it was because I was a comedian. You know, like I think Unfamous Comedian trumped black with her family.
Right.
But I also feel like that the real change is that since we've had a daughter, my wife told me that her mom was like, so does that mean that Sammy's black? Because she just never thought about that. You know, and in her life, I'm sure when she grew up and got married and had kids and thought about her kids, she didn't picture a black granddaughter. Now, she's a great grandmother, and I don't think she's treated Sammy worse because she's black. She loves Sammy. But I think it's somehow altering her perception of the world in a way that I think is awesome. Now, for me, the other thing is that when Sammy was first born, Sammy was very light. And I would walk around in the world with this baby who looked to be white. And we got a lot of weird stares because, you know, a black guy with a white baby is not the most popular color combination. You know, we're all very used to the white guy with the black baby because you're like, oh, that's very nice of you to adopt that child from that place. But with me, it was a whole different thing. And we got a lot of stares and a lot of questions that I had to deal with while at the same time knowing that I didn't care what people thought because this was my daughter. And this is a true story. When my daughter was born, you know, it's a very emotional moment. Your kid is born. They hand you the kid. They wipe the kid off, and you're just sitting there with your kid. And I actually realized when I looked at my daughter's eyes that it was the first time in my life that I was looking at somebody and they didn't think of me as black, that I knew for sure that she didn't think of me as black. She just thought of me as dad. Well, at that point, she probably thought of me as like, oh. She thought of me as the one that didn't have milk. But that was a very important moment for me to realize that this is actually, that's how embedded race is in me, which I think is kind of sad, but also that how exciting a moment that was for me, that I know for sure this person doesn't think of me as black.
Now, so much comedy club material is about sex and about being great at it or being terrible at it or getting it or not getting it or anyway, so you've actually worked at a condom store and at a video store that sold adult videos. So I'm thinking you must have material galore, even though you're not the kind of comic who talks a lot about sex. What were those experiences like?
I mean, you know, I think the reason I don't talk about those experiences a lot on stage is because I know comics who do incredible sex material, and I feel like that's not my strength. So I would gladly give those stories to those comedians if they wanted them. But the working at the video store, I mean, it was one of those video stores that you walked in and it was like, this is the worst video store I've ever seen. They only have like Jurassic Park 3 and like Home Alone 4. And you're like, how does this video store survive? And then there's a door in the back that leads to stairs that go up. And it's all the porno that's ever been created in the history of the world. And that was the video store I worked at. All the videos downstairs were dusty. And you get a real window into male humanity in that way. Because it was also a video store. Again, it was in Chicago on the edge of the gay area. So we had probably twice as much gay porn as we had straight porn. And I think that's actually where I started to learn about the fluidity of human sexuality. Because I would regularly see guys who were renting from the straight side of the porn section. Over time, they rented so much straight porn that they would start to leak over to the gay side of the porn section. Just because I think they were like, I've seen everything this combination of people can do. And so let me go look over to this combination. And it really was an eye-opener to like, oh, I guess human sexuality is on a spectrum. And, you know, it was a very funny time. I also had a guy say to me one time, like, man, he's like, you work here a lot. I see you here all the time. And I remember thinking, no, I see you here all the time. I get paid to be here.
So since you were working in the store, were you expected to have seen a lot of the videos so that you could be helpful to people?
Yeah, there is a weird thing where you're expected to have the same recommendations you're expected to have if you work at a regular video store, you're expected to have at the adult video store. And at the time, I'm not saying I'm any kind of Puritan. I just wasn't partaking at the level that I was going to have a top 10 list or a list of suggestions. Occasionally people would come in and say that a tape was broken and you would have to sort of play the tape on your VCR to make sure that it was or wasn't broken, which is a very surreal experience of like, nope, looks fine to me. I can see all the body parts doing the things that they're supposed to be doing. It's funny. When you work in a place like that, it becomes very regular after a while. It's just what you do for a living.
Well, W. Kamau Bell, it's really been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This is an extreme honor.
W. Kamau Bell speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. The season finale of Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell is September 20th on FX. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Kevin Griffin. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yowei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.